Hello and welcome to Broome Airport on the far northwest coast of Australia. I'm Kirsty Melville from the ABC, and along with Neil Trevithick from the BBC, we're going to explore the biggest mining boom in my country's history. Western Australia dug $110 billion worth of minerals out of the ground last year. Most of that was south of here, but I'm with some of the very few miners digging in the largely pristine wilderness of the Kimberley region.
Don't sit next to Jahari on the plane. He's a panicker. Make sure you record that. Jahari bin Demon of 9 Tarji Road.
That's Tony Shower, MD and irrepressible chief executive of boutique mining company Pluton Resources. Join us on this tiny aeroplane as Tony and his miners take us to see something extraordinary, miles from anywhere on a remote island in the Buccaneer Archipelago.
Seatbelts include a lap strap and a shoulder harness. So obviously, put it on, clip it up, tighten with the black tail, and then to undo it, lift the metal clasp when you're away. If you hear me at any stage say, ditching, 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 I'll get you to pivot around to the front, lift that orange tab. Any questions? Nope, happy as Larry, all right.
Soon we're up in the air and looking down on the endless sage-green scrub and red soil of the Kimberley, more than twice the size of the UK, but with only around 40,000 inhabitants, of whom half are Aboriginal.
So we're approaching in a couple of minutes the mouth of King Sound, and that's the gateway to the Buccaneer Archipelago. The Buccaneer Archipelago is about 1,500 islands. It's a big eco-tourist area, and nestled in the middle of it are three islands called the Kimberley Iron Ore Hub. They're the only three islands out of the 1,500 that have iron ore, commercial quantities of iron ore. It's amazing that you can have a development like the Iron Ore Hub in one of the most pristine wildernesses in the world, let alone Australia. It creates a lot of employment, creates a lot of income for the indigenous groups. They're very poor group. Just this week in Broome, we know of two Indigenous suicides happened on Tuesday, both people that we knew. So while environmental groups would say we would prefer iron ore to be in the Pilbara, which is a mess, our answer to that is that it provides jobs and opportunity for Indigenous people who without this really have no opportunity at all.
I told you, Jahari, you should sit up the front. You're too fat to sit up the back, right? Sit up the front.
This is Cockatoo Island, 6 kilometres long and about a kilometre at its widest. Mined for iron ore since the 1950s, it looks as if it's been cut almost in half, right down to the waterline. Literally like cutting a cake with a knife. And the half that's no longer here, some of the highest grade iron ore on earth, is loaded straight onto ships for export. Tony and his company are taking over Cockatoo and using it as a base to begin mining Irvine Island next door.
Okay, today's a wonderful day for both Pluton and the Dambie Mangari people. For the Dambie, it marks the day that you have reclaimed access to an important part of your traditional lands that has been long denied.
But they're doing something entirely new. They're including the traditional owners of Cockatoo in the ceremony and opening up the island to the people who've traversed the wild tides of the Buccaneer Archipelago for thousands of years. Donny Woolagudja has heard the stories of Cockatoo all his life. But today is the first time he's set foot on his land. For more than 50 years, previous operators of the mine simply banned them from their own island. Donny and his mate Alfie remember the stories of when their elders first came across whitefellas.
We didn't have any communication
with them,
anybody.
How they speak and them just using their own language, when you go die, eh? They talk to one another, who are you? But...
And what they first heard when I saw a white man coming to their country, they said, Agula.
Yeah, ghost,
Ghost, because of the skin. So they ran away to the bush, they saw Agula coming to take over our country. They painted them in a cave too, to make sure that they
don't.
Hang
on, you just said to me they painted in a cave. What did, that they did drawings in a cave.
Yeah, drawing.
Of the devil's head.
Yep.
And are the paintings still there in the caves?
Yeah, they're still there.
Where?
Up north.
And those paintings are much more recent than you might think.
When you talk about history, in the late 60s, early 70s, we still have Aboriginal people walking out of the desert areas, having first contact. A number of the Kimberley Land Council's executive members were all first contact. One senior man from the coastal area, Lewis Karadatta. When we engage with a big multinational Impex for building an LNG plant on the Kimberley coast, his oral stories were when he was between 12 and 14, he was canoeing around Merritt Islands with his parents and was brought into Watchalum by the missionaries. We're not talking about some archaeological report or some historical National Geographic kind of story about where did the primitive Aboriginal people live. This is living history.
This beautiful and rather surreal cut-in-half paradise mine island has also been a resort. And once the speeches and conversation are over, we gather by the swimming pool before boarding the plane and flying back to Broome on the mainland Kimberley, where the next big thing is liquefied natural gas, or LNG.
Do you remember those ads for Come to West Australia, Elle Macpherson and all that? And she was on a horizon pool with her arms out talking? This is the horizon pool. So Elle Macpherson's been in here, and I still think some of her DNA's in there, and I'm proof you jump in, you come out looking better.
Once upon a time, as with the stunning Cockatoo Island, the government and mining companies did as they liked and mined anywhere with little regard for Aboriginal people or the environment. Some would argue they still do. But that was long before what's known here as native title. Wayne Bergman, who you heard just before our swim, is the CEO of Cred Enterprises, a trust dedicated to building and sustaining economic development for his people. And he's been fighting for Aboriginal rights in the Kimberley for many years.
Under international law, there were three ways in which foreign countries claimed land. They conquered it, so by war, it was succeeded, so given up, or the third one, it was settled, and settled had a particular meaning that the land was empty. And then in 1992, the High Court of Australia said the concept of settlement in Australia was a fiction. The doctrine of terra nullius, meaning that the Australia was empty and not occupied, was false. And therefore, if that was false, then it was open for Aboriginal people then to claim in basically their inherent rights to land, which created a massive upheaval because it meant that some land may be subject to compensation. In remote Australia, evidence of occupation and use is, you know, 40 years ago, some places 30 years ago. There should be no reason why Aboriginal people in the north part of Australia should not get native title where you have that such recent contact with Western society.
It's the heavily mined Pilbara region to the south that's known as the engine room of Australia. But the global resources boom has now arrived in this remote Kimberley region. There's money to be spent, resources to extract, and the frontline project is a large liquefied natural gas processing plant at the pristine and very beautiful James Price Point, just north of Broome. The fight against the gas plant has captured the imagination of greenies across Australia and divided local Aboriginal traditional owners. But the state government's pro-mining and pushing hard for its go-ahead.
Well, mining is the dominant economy in Western Australia. This state only has 2.4 million people.
West Australian Premier Colin Barnett.
We occupy an area larger than Europe. So let's get it in perspective. China is Australia's major trading partner. 73% of all of Australia's exports to China come from Western Australia, and most of it is mineral, petroleum, and to a lesser extent, agricultural production. So we're a very highly specialised, highly export-orientated economy. There are vast resources in this state. Iron ore production used to only be about 60% iron content. We're now down to mining some of the 35% grade. Thought they would never be developed. 10 years ago, no prospect. The gas reserves off the West Australian coast will last for probably 100 years and will continue to probably be the dominant mineral and petroleum economy in Southeast Asia.
Pat Dodson is a Yawuru man from Broome and one of the great Aboriginal leaders of Australia. When you look at a map of his country, and indeed most of the Kimberley, it's a sea of mining exploration licences. Does he look at these maps?
I look at the map of Australia every time I fly from here to Sydney or I fly over Australia. I see squares where sheep and cattle are growing and farms are there, and I see westernisation spreading out all over Australia, the growth of Melbourne and Sydney into mega cities, you know.
But this is a fresh onslaught
Well, what's new about it? What I'm saying is what's new about it? It is it's consistent with the colonisation thrust to take the lands off the Aboriginal peoples, isn't it?
I agree, but it's a fresh onslaught.
Well, it's not fresh in the sense to Kimberley people. It's not fresh to the Australian colonisers.
Another wave.
Well, yeah, and that's how things happen, incrementally. Incrementally, Aboriginal people get displaced, environments get despoiled, people get disconnected. That's the method of Australian development. Until Australians wake up to that and do something about it, it's very hard for us to do something sitting out here in the Kimberley when, you know, the blokes who make the money are sitting down at Wilson's Promontory somewhere in a big house. Holes are up here and he's down there sniffing the sea breeze and having a nice view. So what?
Well, what you're talking about here, though, in the Kimberley is the perfect storm of a receptive global economic climate, a government that's very keen to pursue resource development in this region.
Governments, not just one government.
And companies who are in a financial position to exploit these opportunities now. How are you feeling about this situation?
Well, I probably know too much about Australian history to think that this is something that's going to be different to what's been in the past.
I wonder what Wayne Bergman's past was like.
No different to any other Kimberley Aboriginal person. Went to the local Catholic school. I discovered more detail later because my family never talked about it. My great-grandmother was taken away from her mother. There's a memorial in the Derby jail and the same prison cells exists where they locked her and her sister up. And a bit of oral history and some recording from the early missionaries of our great-grandmother crying and singing out to Sarah, and the kids were locked in the cell, and then 3 o'clock in the morning put on a railway cart and taken to the Derby jetty and brought around here to Broome, and then was taken off and given to the nuns, and the nuns put them on a wagon and took them up to Beagle Bay. I found actually photos of Granny, and she would have been maybe 7 or 8, and I'm standing with this whole bunch of kids that were up there. And I just can't personally understand, and I often question about, in that context, how could anyone in their right mind justify finding some kids playing on a street, giving them lollies? You know, we put people in jail for doing this, and then putting them on the back of a vehicle and then driving them away. I've got kids myself, and it just absolutely ripped you apart.
Hey mom, I can just taste your fish soup and rice. I'm coming back home to you. Can't act the pace of the city life. Soon I'll be dreaming in Broome.
These are Broome's favourite musical sons, the Pigram Brothers. They sing about their love for this small town of some 15,000 people, perched on a spectacular coastline of red, red cliffs, and how it just captures your heart. That's what happened to Peter Tucker when he first set foot on this country here. So much so that when he got wind of the plans to build the gas hub at James Price Point, he set up an NGO called Save the Kimberley.
One of the great beauties of Broome is its people. It's probably one of the only nations where the White Australian policy was basically non-existent, you know, because that existed up until whatever it was, the 40s. But Broome, no, they relied heavily on indentured labour from Asian countries and so forth, and now that's the fabric of Broome. I find it quite refreshing when you are going to meet Neil Hamaguchi, but Neil Hamaguchi is half black fella, but he looks like a Japanese bloke, you know, and it's lovely. Or you go and meet Rohana Binhitam. But Rohana Binhitam is part Malaysian, or half Malaysian, but half blackfella. And then you might go and meet Kenny Gibson. And his old man was Scottish, but his mother was a full-blood, you know, I think it's fantastic. And everyone gets on well. And of course, my children, who are half Japanese, blend in so well. It's really, really good. And that's the strength of this community. Yeah.
I'd like to kind of start focusing on the James Price Point issue. Can you take us back to when you first got an inkling that there was interest in development there?
Back in 2005, things fell off the perch in the way in which these big companies wanted to engage. They wanted to do processes that cost nothing. It became very difficult because the Kimberleys were one of the few places where Aboriginal people were organised. And so then they started to pay for different levels of community consultation and engagement through the Kimberley Land Council.
Wayne Bergman. Now, after years of complex consultation, which Wayne has been a part of, a $1.5 billion compensation deal is promised to the traditional owners here if the gas plant at James Price Point goes ahead. That money, which has created huge expectations, will be lost to the community if the gas plant doesn't go ahead.
There's been so many structures put in place to deal with this incoming money that's supposedly going to happen. But what if it all falls over? What then?
I'm in two minds. I'd be disappointed. But I also, my position has always been, if the plans aren't in place, then it shouldn't go ahead, because the community and the Kimberleys would be heading for a train wreck. And that predominantly still concerns me. I don't see any management plan dealing with the social impacts. The types of plans I've seen are things to the effect of, there will be an Indigenous cultural management plan. That's just a statement, that's not a plan. You know, I went to boarding school in Perth, and one of my first experiences going into the science lab and the teacher saying, get me a test tube, and walking into the storeroom being too ashamed to say, what's a test tube? And then scratching my head, looking around for something that had tea on it so I could try and find what a test tube was. And the teacher storming in and say, Bergman, you know, here it is. What's taken you so long? Had no idea. So kind of growing up and coming from that background of just completely in the deep end, dealing with some of the biggest powerful companies and trying to mould and create something that people could be proud of and would make a difference to people's lives. So I kind of admire and very proud of what we were able to achieve in that context. I'm certainly torn. You can't help but be in this area and feel this tranquility and this connection. You know, one of the sunsets up here, you feel your body melt into the environment. You know, you can't help it. I mean, you get, it is absolutely beautiful area. But then there is a large part of the traditional owner population also who no one talks to, who see tourists going up there camping all over their traditional country without permission, even though the gas project might be a difficult pill to swallow. It had elements of trying to work with Aboriginal people.
The gas itself is many miles offshore in the Browse Basin, but James Price Point is where it will be piped to, frozen, and then exported on gas tankers from a port to be built on the same site. Opponents of the plant are fighting for an offshore floating hub. But the West Australian Premier, Colin Barnett, is determined to have the gas processed onshore.
By bringing the gas onshore, there will be jobs for Australians in building and operating the gas plant. If it was offshore, in other words on a floating barge, no jobs for Australians, either in construction or in operation. The second reason is that that gas belongs to Australia. It does not belong to the international oil and gas companies. And indeed, because there are islands in the area, one of the curiosities of the Australian constitutional arrangement is that those islands are Western Australia. So around one third of the gas belongs to the state government of Western Australia, two thirds belongs to the Australian government. We share in the ownership. That gas is important for householders as town gas, as a clean source of electricity generation, and that gas therefore needs to come onshore so it can be used by Western Australia and perhaps the wider Australian economy.
It's almost 20 minutes to 8 on ABC Kimberley Breakfast. This is Billy Bragg teaming up with Wilco.
The drive to James Price Point from Broome is along a typical Kimberley coastal road, red corrugated earth.
Oh, my little girlie, will you let me see? Way over yonder where the wind blows free.
Now it's time to meet the people who don't want a gas plant here, ever. If they win their battle, then the huge compensation package coming to the community will vanish into thin air.
Way over yonder in the minor key. Way over yonder in the minor key. There ain't nobody that can sing like me.
One man whose family has done as much as anyone else's to look after this country is Philip Rowe. First, his grandfather Paddy, and now Philip and his brother Joe have walked this coast all of their lives. Paddy's life's work was setting up the Luridgeri Trail in the late 80s, a 9-day trek that shares the Aboriginal knowledge and culture of this coastline. We find his grandson Philip on the dunes next to the Greenie protest camp on James Price Point.
Phil, can you tell me the story of this campsite here?
This campsite here?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is all part of where we just came from. This is all part of Walmerdon. James Price, this is all Walmerdon.
Come on. Who is Walmerdon?
Walmerdon, he was an old man. He's a warrior. And where we're going now, he's up on the sand dune. Where we're going to pass here, this used to be the main waterhole in here.
How often did you come here when you were growing up?
Me? I've been here since day one. I used to come with my old grandfather here.
Oh, it's deceptive. The snake.
Be brown. Same old mate. Now we stand here. Other side those dunes, there's old people buried there. This were old Walmerdon. My grandfather buried him just on the other side there. As you can see, all this, it'll be gone. They'll push that, they'll push all the graves. That old fella, they'll push him. Under there, see this big tree? It's been here for years and years and years. That's what they want to destroy. All this here, it'll be gone. That ocean will be here.
In the next half hour on the BBC World Service, we'll hear more from the environmental protesters, or Greenies as we call them here in Australia, who are camped where the ocean will pour in to make a tanker port. People like Darren.
I thought I'd pop up. There was a cry come out while I was down in Tasmania and thought, yeah, well, that's what Aussies do. You go up and help your mates. This is a potential disaster ready to happen. Instead of, you know, cleaning up after a cyclone or stuff like that, this is man-made, so we could stop it before it even starts.
See you shortly.
BBC. 10 years ago, the invasion of Iraq led to global controversy. Saddam Hussein was removed from power and the USA and Britain occupied the country.
My name's Hugh Sykes. I've been to Iraq several times a year for the past 10 years, reporting for the BBC. It's been a decade of danger, distress and despair in the country.
As I feel sad about my country, because there's no one care about us. But I'm here because I love this country. I love my Iraq.
Turning, eventually, to some hope.
The security situation is different. People are feeling safe. You had 2 explosions in the same hour, but for now we have 2 explosions in 1 week. This is the difference.
I've witnessed Iraq emerging from its nightmare, but it remains a work in progress.
After Saddam, Hugh Sykes returns to Iraq. Online from Tuesday at bbcworldservice.com.
Over the next half hour, we'll hear what the people of Broome on the far northwest coast of Western Australia feel about the possibility of a huge liquefied natural gas plant being built on the beach nearby, and how it may change their world forever. There'll be big winners and big losers, whichever way the decision about the plant goes. An opinion in the town is split right down the middle. Join us for the start of the mango season and more Red Dirt Dreaming coming up shortly.
BBC News with David Austin. Australian soldiers in southern Afghanistan have shot dead 2 Afghan shepherd boys, both under the age of 7. The NATO-led international force in Afghanistan said a coalition helicopter had opened fire after mistaking the boys for Taliban insurgents during an operation on Thursday. Thousands of people have marched through the Russian capital, Moscow, urging the authorities to ban all foreign adoptions. The march was organised after doctors in the United States concluded that the death of an adopted Russian three-year-old boy was an accident. Mass demonstrations have been taking place across Portugal in protest at the government's austerity measures. At one rally in the capital, Lisbon, students and teachers gathered in front of the Education Ministry to protest against education cuts. An Iraqi hospital is treating a number of Syrian soldiers wounded in fighting against rebels at a border post inside Syria. Iraqi officials said at least four soldiers had fled into Iraq after being hurt during clashes at Yarubir. Kenya's presidential candidates have held their final rallies before elections on Monday. The front runners, Raila Odinga and Uhuru Kenyatta, both made pleas for peace at large gatherings in the capital, Nairobi. Thousands of people have attended the birthday party of the Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe in the mining town of Bindura. The cake was said to weigh 89 kilograms, matching the president's age. Special gold coins were minted to mark the occasion. Reports say the party cost about $600,000. And a pet dog in Poland has been praised for helping a three-year-old girl to survive a freezing night after she went missing. The girl, called Julia, was found more than 3 kilometres from her home, lying in water in a marshy area beside her dog. She was suffering from frostbite. Firefighters say the dog probably helped save Julia's life by keeping her body warm. BBC News.
Every year at the end of the dry season, the mangoes ripen along the West Kimberley, and suddenly the trees are laden, their branches hanging low and the air thick with their sickly sweet smell. They're everywhere. Enough to have a mango festival in Broome to celebrate their variety and plenty. Come with me, Kirsty Melville, here on the BBC World Service, and enjoy.
I feel like going back home.
Cutting up mangoes. Broome has 140 varieties of mangoes. So you have peach mango, lemon mango.
And the blue moon's starting to bite.
Today I'm cutting up banana mango.
Does
so
it really taste like banana?
No, that one looks like it. So sometimes their name comes from the way they look or the way they taste. So this one tastes more like a pawpaw and looks like a banana. But it's actually a mango.
We're up here doing a story on the Kimberley and development, and we just wanted to get an idea of how people are feeling about the development at James Price Point.
Oh, okay, wait, I've got to think about it. You've got something pithy to say? I really believe that they should have it offshore and piped down to Karratha, where there's already the infrastructure. I think that the mob that was given the money for letting the government go ahead with it was coerced into it. So I do think by the government, you know, it was forced acquisition. So that's my opinion.
Is there any overwhelming flavour to it?
Mango.
It's lemon mango.
It's a lemon mango.
If it does fall through, then all the rent's going to come down. People are going to lose a lot of money on their investments and a lot of other things as well.
So you think it should go ahead?
Well, if it doesn't, town will sort of fall in a bit of a hole.
Did you swim there?
You can walk out there off the beach and pick up crayfish just on the reef at low tide. Like, that's all going to go. You can't do it anywhere else.
I'm on the fence with the gas thing. There's positives and negatives. I guess an influx of people as well. It'll turn into a mining town. Rent prices will go up and things like that. So, but I'm on the fence.
Yes, Mum, more melon, Mum.
It's lost all local industry, like it's lost the pearling. Fishing industry's gone down the tube. I mean, there's nothing really holding Broome together.
We need more things behind us in this town.
How do you feel about the development if it goes ahead at James Price Point?
Dreadful. Worst thing could happen to the Kimberley. It's so beautiful, pristine, just unbelievable. It'll ruin the whole Kimberley because everything else will start from that.
If Broome's going to survive, they need infrastructure like this, definitely. Jobs, more than anything.
It's dividing everybody. It's destroying the town. It's strangling the town. The hurt, the disappointment, it's just come down to pure greed, and the people should be disgusted with themselves.
So should it go ahead?
No. Absolutely
not. My name is Martin Pritchard. I'm the director of Environs Kimberley, a small environmental non-government organisation based here in Broome. In 2010, the WA Premier, Colin Barnett, stated that the Pilbara had been the backbone of Western Australia's economy for the past 50 years, but he thought the Kimberley would be the backbone for WA's economy for the next 60 years.
What interests me is how you place value on the word that I've heard endlessly in the last week, which is pristine. People say the Kimberley is pristine. It's the last great wilderness area apart from Antarctica. Are we moving towards an era where you can compare the value of mining, which is easy in dollars, and the value of a last great wilderness?
I understand the philosophical point you make, but I also understand that someone has to make a decision, and that is a government or a premier or a minister. Look, I think the Kimberley is one of the world's great wilderness areas. It's not the only one. Siberia, lots of places, Antarctica itself. But it is significant and it's got a low population. And I understand fully why a debate might centre around an irrigation project or a site for a gas plant. The reality, though, the threat to the Kimberley is not that. The threat to the Kimberley is feral species, both plant and animal, far more significant. And that is what the state government is trying to deal with. That is the big environmental issue for the Kimberley. And what frustrates me, I guess, as a premier, is so much effort, so much scientific effort, so much financial resource, so much emotion and passion by people concentrates on a very small area where a gas plant might be built. Where's the emotion, passion about protecting it from introduced feral species? That's the issue for the Kimberley. Far, far greater risk.
But Pat Dodson sees threats from every direction.
There's the cattle industry, there's the tourism industry, there's the mining industry at exploration. Mind you, there's not too many mines in the Kimberley as yet, but there's certainly a high level of activity. You've got to correlate that to the land and water study that was done by the federal government, looking at the land and water resources for future agricultural and horticultural exploitation of northern Australia. I bet no one's had a look at that plan. To meet in part the destruction and desecration that took place along the Murray-Darling river systems, where the settlers first went in order to make their money. So the greed and the avarice is transported north, or trying to transport itself here north. We will destroy a pristine part of our world.
Well, what we've seen coming in here to this community are a lot of people who are very conflicted about the best way to move forward, about whether you make the most of these opportunities that some are saying are the opportunity of a lifetime, and others who are saying the best way to help Indigenous people is to keep that connection to country going by not doing any more to damage the environment. So how difficult is that, to walk that line?
On the one hand, Aboriginal culture can't be frozen in time. You just can't say, well, keep that connection, because most of our dialogue and narrative is post-colonial impact. That is, when the British came here and declared this terra nullius through the doctrine of discovery, and then fundamentally subjugated the Aboriginal peoples. The narrative for the last 200 years has fundamentally been about justice and equity and settlement. We had a court case here called Mabo, which overturned the legal fiction called terra nullius, which was the lie upon which settlement was based. There's no recognition of the Aboriginal people in the Australian Constitution, so that has to be fixed. That doesn't mean that the culture stopped in 1788, but there's been an interruption to a lot of the cultural knowledge and connection to country.
That narrative, that interruption, that disconnection from country and clash with modernity has led to troubled communities, to depression, and for many, to suicide. There were three suicides in the Broome area just in the week we were here.
It is such a common occurrence that it's sort of, you know, it's not as shocking to us anymore as it would be to a visitor who comes in from the outside and goes, wow.
When did it start?
I suppose in the time when I was, you know, the vulnerable age, I suppose, there was very little, if none, happening. So I would suggest everything would be after the mid-90s probably that sort of coming in, and then just over the last 10 years it's been an epidemic.
Why do you think that's happened? What's changed?
I suppose religion played a big part in the old days. The Catholics in particular, I think, had a very strong influence on suicide. When I grew up, it was always suicide is a really bad sin and you'll go to hell if you commit suicide. And in a lot of Catholic or Christian places, they wouldn't bury you if you committed suicide because you've committed one of the mortal sins. So that sort of fear, I suppose, probably helped a lot of people in that I'm not going to do that because I'm not going to go to heaven, you know.
Development, so-called development, brings drugs. It brings other problems into these places. If we are concerned about the environment to that extent, there should be an equal concern about the human beings who are being decimated in the process here, you know. And that's true of other people in other nations. So that the decimation of the people is critical. We're just not a species of native that you can replace. We have the oldest living continuous culture in the world as the Aboriginal peoples of this country. So you can't replace us easily. But if we are being decimated through the ill effects of modernity, alcohol, drugs and all the other things, even the food that we get fed, then there's got to be serious concern about those things. Instead of the condemnation we get about not wanting to jump into modernity.
For Aboriginal people, after thousands and thousands of years of occupancy, for them it is their one roll of the dice. This is the critical decision they're making, being respectful of thousands of years of Aboriginal history and also for the future. And I can understand the emotional pull that places on people. And I've seen, you know, face-to-face, sitting on the beach, talking to Aboriginal people, they are just so fearful of not getting it right. And yet, I think they understand this is their one opportunity for economic self-determination. So the pressure on individuals, the leaders of the Aboriginal people, is very great.
It's huge. Mm. That's one of the great things that we walked away from this seeing, actually, was just, even with Wayne Bergman, you could still, even now, see the pressure on him over this.
But the pressures are there, but I think the pressure is not only should there be some development or no development at all, the pressure is really, do we leave our people on welfare dependency, or are we brave enough to give them an opportunity at economic self-determination and independence and the pride and place in a wider society that comes with that? I'm on that side of the argument. I appreciate and respect people on the other side of the argument.
Way over on the other side of the argument are the Greenies. There's a colourful, competent and committed environmental protest camp permanently set up on the sand dunes at Womeldown near James Price Point.
My name's George Bishop and I've been here for a bit over a year. I got here last year when the mangoes were on and into the swing of it now. These sand dunes, if you just walk on it, you make a fairly big impact. Pretty unique environment where you've got sand dunes, but they've got fruiting trees and gum trees that instead of growing big and tall are sprawled out because of cyclone winds, and that's what stops the Indian Ocean from coming into this monsoonal vine thicket, like rainforest type bush. And without that, it's just all salt water there.
I'm a Bibul Munyoga, so I'm from southwest of WA. My dad was Stolen Generation, and a lot of our culture and my dad himself were stolen from our people, you know, when he was only a little fella. So for myself, when I saw what was happening here, it's like these guys still have what we never got.
Culture,
connections, family. They still have all of that. They have language, they have law. That was destroyed for us. And when I knew this was happening, it's like, no, I have to come and help.
And why are you here, Sophie?
When it comes down to it, it's just complete degradation of, you know, the environment and culture purely just for money. And you know, to me, that's just wrong.
Darren.
What are they trying to do? Scrub out something that could last forever, like tourism? It's an ongoing dollar. Broome, it's the only place for all the miners down in the Pilbara to come and get away from high-vis. Do they want to turn it into another high-vis brothel town? You fly in, you fly out, nobody cares what's going on because they're going home somewhere else across the other side of Australia. So they come in here, they dig this joint up, they go home. They don't care. And that's what I've seen in Port Hedland and a little bit more in Karratha too.
Right past this protest camp runs the Lurajari Trail created by Paddy Rowe, widely regarded as a national treasure. He was granted an Order of Australia for his work in helping people to understand the cultural heritage of his country. His grandsons Joe and Philip are continuing the Rowe family tradition.
Well, that's from my mum's place. It's a 9-day trek.
goes right to Minari and finish at Bijanangwan, Yellow River. It brings everyone together.
And what's the meaning behind the trail? Does it follow a songline?
Yeah, this is the northern part of the songline index. I'm sorry, I can't give you too much because it's hard for you guys to understand till you gotta live and experience.
Can we go for a walk somewhere?
You wanna go walk a bit?
And we do. The Rowe family has been heavily criticised by fellow traditional owners who support the gas plant. They've been accused, among other things, of not belonging to this country. Ironically, the strongest supporter of the Rowes we found was the well-built mining company man in our tiny plane at the very beginning of our journey, Johari bin Denham.
My heritage is Jabba Jabba and Jaru. Paddy, to some extent, has been discredited here. I find that really poor, you know. Look, the reality is, in the 70s, it wasn't fashionable to be a blackfella. It was more fashionable to say you had everything else but a blackfella, because you tended to get more opportunities. Paddy used to come under schools, free of charge, to teach all children in school, whether you're black or white, about Indigenous culture, tell stories. He'd tell the stories, and his old partner, old Butcher Joe, used to do the illustrations. And that'd sit there with us once a week. Paddy would tell the story, Butcher Joe would do the illustrations. That sort of awakened us and gave us an interest. And he was genuinely the, you know, if Pat Dodson's the father of reconciliation, well, Paddy's definitely the founder and grandfather of reconciliation. Later on, he entertained a lot of the universities from over east and took them on the heritage trail before it became a trial, and then that concept sort of grew and state government got behind it.
There's been a lot of discrediting of Joe Rowe, of the grandsons, Joe and Philip, as well, yep, in this whole debate. Mm-hmm. How reasonable is that?
Oh, totally unreasonable, I think, you know. The truth is, all my life I've gone up to James Price Point. I would guarantee you, I reckon every trip or every second trip, the family would be out there. You'd bump into them. And now they stand up in front of everyone and criticise the Rowes, and it's gone, whoa, get off the grass, you know.
No one is seriously trying to upset the capitalist model in terms of let's exploit the resources and get as much as we can out of it. I don't think anyone's having that debate. As such, I would wish the media would be a bit more insightful and critical about these aspects of it, rather than is there a fight between the Greens and the miners, and whether some bloke sitting up on a pole, he's totally irrelevant, that guy, because he'll go away tomorrow, he'll go to some other place. If he got up on a pole and outside the police station about the suicides, about the drugs, about these other sorts of issues, I'd be very happy. I'd probably get a pole and sit up there with him. But I'm not going to do it when they're just swanning around hoping that they're going to be on the press tonight.
One thing that's not understood is that these natural resources are not particularly high grade. The success of the mining industry in Western Australia has been the application of science and technology to take large, low-grade resources and make them commercially viable. And that plays, science is the background in this industry. And I want everyone, including Aboriginal people and kids, to do science and engineering degrees and construction and process operators and computer specialists. I don't want them to see their career choice is only looking after nature.
What they're doing is selling the country to get a few dollars. Our family, the Gularabulu family group, we are still strong, and we will stay strong because our grandfather taught us the right way to go and things, to fight and look after a country, you know. It's our duty to do it. He handed to us, and so we'll continue his journey.
Hey mum, I can just taste your fish soup and rice. I'm coming back home to you. Connect the pace of the city life. Soon I'll be dreaming in blue.
James Price Point is the first cab off the rank, and there's going to be a very significant pause, we believe, within industry and government if James Price Point doesn't go ahead. And that's the opportunity we want to take to get together with government and industry and work out a future for the Kimberley that doesn't involve destroying it.
Nothing here seems straightforward anymore. There are very few Aboriginal people who wholeheartedly support or oppose mining. Almost all are conflicted about the best way forward for their people. And some prefer dealing with mining companies to the government.
Here's an opportunity. You're not being controlled by the government, because when you try and work with the government, the rules of the government changes every time the government changes. The government is there for 4 years. They might have this nice program, works really well for one party and didn't work for the other. Sorry, we've got to change it. What we found with mining agreements, you're working with a business partner with an agreement. It's set there for the life of the industry. So if we're lucky in the case of the Irvine, if that goes for 50 years, well, we've got a good generation that will have an opportunity to be able to, one would hope, grow and develop, and then be able to move away even from being dependent on the industry and just keep moving forward as strong Aboriginal people.
In a recent series of nationally broadcast lectures here in Australia, leading Aboriginal scholar Marcia Langton examined how government policies lag far behind the private sector mining companies in the way they work with Indigenous Australia. Pluton Resources, who we met earlier in the program, are a good example of this. Langton posits a quiet revolution of Aboriginal achievement and transformation through participation in the modern economy. But the devil, as ever, is in the detail. The most empowered, impressive and unconflicted Aboriginal people we met while making this program live even further north on the remote Dampier Peninsula. A woman running an eco-tourism resort, communities running cultural heritage tours, and these guys, the Badi Jarvi Rangers of One Arm Point, at the mouth of the King Sound, a place of scouring tides and harsh beauty. You may remember that we flew over here right at the beginning of the program. To ride these waves and bareback mermaids. Oh, the saltwater country is my home. I can't believe this tide. It's like a river. It's like a fast-flowing river, but it's...
You want to get a canoe and I'll... push you off there and time you what time you'll come round the bend.
Well, this will go out way back. We have the biggest tide in the southern hemisphere up here, anything up to 11 metres. So on your 11 metre tides, 10 metre tides, we can have anything up to 40 knots of current.
So if you got on there on a Lilo, yeah, right now, where would you end up with this tide?
End up down there somewhere, out there in the ocean there.
Cape Le Vic.
We've got the current moving left to right at the moment from inside the King Sound. So if I want to go down with the tides going out to the lowest island, we've got the Twill Islands, we're probably 6 nautical miles out this way. I'll take the outgoing tide from here,
yeah,
and that tide will take me right down there. Now, if I want to go halfway there, I'll wait till the tide's halfway down, because I know it's going to turn in 1.5 hours. So I know I'm not going to miss. If I do miss the island, I'll get the back tide. So it comes under timing and planning.
And knowledge.
Knowledge. Without knowledge, well, we could be in big trouble. All our boys here can travel through these islands here with no moon in a tinny, you know. We grew up here, this is our backyard. Billions and billions and billions of tons of water flows into the King Sound and out again. You know, we're talking about Sydney Harbour and all that. There's nothing compared to this, what flows in here.
Just by looking at this, you know, you might have electricity sort of thing.
Harnessing this energy.
Harnessing this energy just by from the tide. Because the Australian dollar and the meat is costing too much.
But the cost of power is going up, so it might be a long term
thing. It might be, yeah.
We want to run our own power. Anybody want to come in partnership, you know? We pay, what do we call this mob here? The power's going on up and up and up. Reality, we should have solar power up here. We get sun for like 320 days a year. We should have said, come on, let's take a risk and go and JV or joint venture with somebody and put a solar power system, and you know, we'll manage it together.
Yeah.
Let's go and get a $4 million loan or a $6 million loan and go in partnership with somebody. We own the power then. The revenues come back to our community. We'll get to the stage where we're going to have to manage all our affairs and take some high risk. Stand back. You're shallow water. I'm moving.
thank you to Bibbidow. One lesson here is that if you let Aboriginal people keep their country and empower them economically, everything else may just follow. Empower them economically by forcing them to sell the country that embodies their spirit, and everything may fail. Next week, join me, Kirsty Melville, here on the BBC World Service as we head south to the engine room of Australia, the Pilbara, mined for the past 50 years by some of the biggest resource companies on the planet. This is where the money talks, and it's the blueprint for modernity's model of what the town of Broome and the rest of the Kimberley should become.
Unfolding like a flower.
The decision on James Price Point is imminent. The road train is about to hit town.
Rising like a mountain through the foggy morn.
First need to be being a mine worker. I'd agree with it. You get a lot of the greenies saying that they shouldn't do it. What do they really give to the Indigenous people? Sweet FA.
I'm opposite of that. And to say that we're not going to survive if we don't have a gas plant down the road is just an absolute ridiculous statement. The divide between the haves and the have-nots will be massive.
And I'm rolling like a road train. 4 dogs and 30 tons.
People who are not supporting the gas at James Price Point have been assaulted, and people have been convicted of those assaults.
Broome was Broome. Everyone used to mingle, get together and things, parties. Now it's broken the whole of Broome in half. It just broke Broome.
Gliding like a mountain towards a blazing sun.
It's outrageous that anyone around here should be feeling these conflictions, because they shouldn't have to sell their land to receive basic public services, and especially Indigenous people in the Kimberley.
There's so many things that are going to change.
We often pose this question amongst our group: if we were to be told the worst case scenario and they're going to go ahead with it, how would I feel? Oh, look, I would suggest it would be war.